This is Wade Bresky. That means it's Wade's World. KABF. It means 9 o'clock to 9:30 Central Standard Time. We're here in Little Rock, Arkansas on KABF 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power on your radio dial. We'll be live streaming this show and every show at www.kabf.org. And by Monday or Tuesday, once our crack team of volunteers gets to it, we'll be having this as a podcast available at KABF/Wade's World. You know the story. Wade's World, we talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Sergio Sosa, Executive Director of the Heartland Workers Center out of Omaha, Nebraska. And Sergio, welcome to Wade's World.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me in the show.
Oh, we're glad to have you, because we're going to talk about a couple of things, not only what Sergio is doing around Nebraska, but particularly, and let's just start with this, there was a Social Policy Magazine Journal article that's come out talking about the children coming from Central America, and that's been in the news. Sergio, you are yourself are from Guatemala, are you not?
Correct. I was raised and born in Guatemala, and I came to the United States around 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
And I'm going back and forth to Guatemala.
Well, and it's a good thing. So what do you make of all this uproar and discussion of children coming from Central America?
Well, I think it is a result of a global problem that it was created by the market society, meaning CAFTA for us, and also the other interventions of countries like Guatemala, where we lived in a civil war for more than 34 years. And I think, you know, that it is a result of a broken immigration system, not just here in the United States, but also in our countries as well.
And unfortunately, we're no closer, it looks like, to mending that broken immigration system. Now, it's ironic, but today's news said that the lowest number of children, some little over 2,000, came across the border, the southwest border between Mexico and the U.S., in the last 2 years. So does that mean this problem's over, or is this just another, you know, deep breath as it continues to pick up steam?
You know, I think, you know, that people want to believe that this problem with children, it is a conjunctural issue, that it was hot, you know, for a while, and now, you know, nobody's talking about it because we moved to a different issue. But it is not an enemy. I just came back from Guatemala, and I spoke with around 40 children in a very tiny school, and I asked them three questions, you know, along with the teachers. The first one was, how many of you have parents, you know, in the United States? And everyone, you know, raised, you know, their hand. And then I asked them, you know, what are you doing after sixth grade? And they said, you know, well, we will try to get to work, get money, hire a coyote, and go to now reunite myself, you know, with my family.
Mm-hmm.
But and then the third question is, you know, what are you doing right now? And they said, you know, well, we are living with my aunt, with my compadre, you know, with compadres, comadres, and but there are too many of us, you know, living in one tiny house. So my aunt is a scandal, you know, because they are becoming sometimes, you know, teenagers. And so they are pushed, you know, to reunite themselves with their families. So and then poverty, you know, it is another big issue that we confront every single day, along with, you know, companies, outside companies, who are exploring the land and the mines. And so the products, you know, like corn, beans, or coffee, they are not, they can harvest, you know, those products, you know, in a bigger amount anymore. So there are structural problems that I think, you know, that this issue of not just students, but a lot of women and males, you know, they will be coming to countries like the United States.
Well, I think that's exactly correct. People don't recognize how strong an economic driver moves people over. And we've talked on Wage World recently, and we have some more shows coming about the problem of Roya, the coffee rust and coffee plantations. It's also driving what some people estimate may, over the next couple of years, be a 500,000 workers from Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. And then clearly security in Honduras. Half of the children are coming from Honduras, the leading city of San Pedro Sula. And we've talked before about ACORN members and colonias in and around San Pedro Sula, who in some cases have had to try to raise $4,000 to $5,000 U.S. Because they weren't sure they could save their children's lives if they didn't get them out of there, because they were being forced to join gangs and be involved in drug handling and every other kind of thing. And that security issue may not be as strong in Guatemala, but in Honduras, that's still a central driver of people north if they can get there.
Yeah, maybe you know, just a couple of things about that. One is, you know, that you were talking about the coffee plantations, and I think, you know, that people need to realize that I grew up in a coffee plantation. You know, my grandpa, you know, have, you know, a lot of land, you know, raised coffee, and but coffee is related with immigration, because a lot of the poor indigenous communities, or, you know, Latino, poor Latino communities, like myself, they plant coffee and they harvest coffee, but also they went to, from the up to the mountains in Huehuetenango, Guatemala, where I'm living, where my parents live at, they went to coffee plantations to looking for work, you know, inside, you know, Guatemala. But then, you know, they also, they went back and forth with the whole family to Mexico, because they go coffee around Quintana Roo and Chiapas. So I think, you know, that not having, you know, the same amount of coffee or the same, you know, land, rich land that we had before, that, you know, also create a lot of problems, you know, for people looking for jobs, you know, and that's another reason why they come to the United States or any country.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, you've said, at least in the social policy piece that I read, that David Bacon, who wrote the piece and quoted you here, said that you see migration as almost a form of resistance to empire. What does he mean by that?
Well, we are living in countries that we have been learning how to survive. And I think, you know, that when you don't find any more economical or political spaces to grow, to change, to also, you know, to fulfill your own dignity, you know, migration comes, you know, as a way to, well, I cannot make it, you know, here anymore, mm-hmm. but I understand, you know, that I am not, you know, alone, I am not, you know, created this burden, so I'll look for a better way to live, you know, meaning that I'm not going to any other country just to create problems or anything, but it is a result of bigger problems. We under the understanding that I am not going to forget that culture that I am coming from, you know, in terms of my family, in terms of economics, in terms of social justice, I guess.
Well, exactly right. And your quote was so moving. I'm going to read the quote that's in this edition that's just hitting people's homes now. Sergio, in the article, is quoted by Bacon as saying, "Now it's our turn to cross borders. Migration is a form of fighting back. We're in our situation not because we've decided to be, but because we're in the U.S.'s backyard. Not only that, people have to resist to keep their communities and identities alive. We're demonstrating that we are human beings, too." And we're talking to Sergio Sosa, the executive director of the Heartland Workers Center, based in Omaha, Nebraska, who himself came over 20 years ago from Guatemala. Sergio, what does the Heartland Workers Center do? Can you give us some, what are y'all doing up there in Nebraska?
Well, first of all, you know, what we're doing, first of all, is to building an organization that it is created and built by immigrants like myself, that we decide to organize ourselves and become protagonists of our own life. Second of all, we have two programs. One is leadership development, and it's based, you know, on our levels of leadership that we learn in our countries, put the talent together and ensure that there is a different ways or different way to organize ourselves. So leadership is important for the Harlem Worker Center. The second is deal with civic engagement, which is a not foreign concept for us because we engage ourselves into many, many activities and actions in our countries. So we wanna reconnect that experience here in the United States or here in Nebraska. And we are also aggressively finding ways to understand how the electoral political system works here in the United States, especially in Nebraska, and get Latinos, Latinas to the polls, and believe, you know, that demographics have been changing across the United States. Latinos are growing across the United States, you know. Nebraska is not exception. But numbers doesn't mean anything if we do not organize ourselves, if we don't go to the polls and cast our vote, but also, you know, to see electoral opportunities beyond themselves, you know, that political engagement has to deal with, you know, issues every single day, year. And the third thing that we do at the Harlem Worker Center is work strikes to promote, educate, inform, and become also, you know, advocate for workers' rights.
Well, and I think a lot of that's exactly right. A lot of people don't realize, but the population of Arkansas has also changed, and maybe for some of the same reasons. People probably don't think of Nebraska as having a large Latino population, but that's changed partially because industries like meat packing and other things are so central up there, and they've hired a lot of Latino workers, haven't they?
Correct. You know, I will tell you, know, that more than 95% of the meat packing plants, construction companies, cleanup companies, fast food industry are Latino-driven workers.
Am I right? I thought I read a couple of years. Well, how did you start the Heartland Center? That was a couple years ago?
Well, yeah, it was five years ago. And I, like I said, you know, I used to work for an organization called Omaha Together One Community, which is affiliated with the Industrial Areas Foundation, IAF, funded by Alinsky.
Right.
And so I learned techniques, you know, of organizing with them and using techniques of organizing with the Catholic Church and the social movement in Guatemala and in popular education with Pablo Freire. I addressed workers in a meat packing plant when I started organizing in Nebraska. But, and then, I'll get into that later on, but the reason why we started the Harlem Worker Center was because many, many Latinos were coming to support many, many activities that organizations or actions that organizations put together. But they were more Anglo-driven efforts. And one day we decided to engage ourselves into the March and rallies in 2006. And we started organizing ourselves. And we spoke with the owners of our meatpacking plant, construction, and many, many bases, and to go out, you know, and fight for immigration reform. But we were told not to do it.
Hmm.
So because we decided to do it on Monday, you know, we were kind of fighting back and forth. But then, you know, one of the leaders said, you know, why are we asking for permission? It is our lives, it is your work, you know, and it is our, you know, we are putting, you know, the people who will be deported, you know, or getting out of jobs. So we decided to do it anyway. And we, for the first time ever in Nebraska, in the downtown Nebraska, downtown Omaha, 20,000 Latinos were marching for, you know, to call for an immigration reform.
Absolutely. Great.
After that, after that, with the leaders, you know, called for a meeting. I was the main organizer, and they said, you know, I think, you know, that we should build our own organization. And they asked me, do you want to work for us? And I said, of course, but let us talk about money here.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
So they raised that night $3,000, you know, themselves. And they said, you know, here is your salary for a year. You know, I was making pretty good money because I was working with, you know, this IAF organization and also somehow, you know, with that the union, you know, UFCW.
Right.
So, and then I took the decision that night with them, you know, to quit my job. I got hired by them, you know, and I was making $3,000. And so, of course, you know, when I went back home, my wife was really, really mad.
Well, I know what you're saying. There's a lot of difference between what the IAF pays and what Acorn organizers were paid. It's probably in the range of two or three times less. So, they are the top of that pay scale, but that's a great story. But it seems to have given you a wide berth to build something real in Omaha and in Nebraska, hasn't it?
Correct. They give us the freedom, you know, to use our cultural, you know, techniques and speak out the language and also decide things for ourselves, you know. And we grew up, you know, from a $3,000, you know, organization to a, you know, almost $500,000 nonprofit organization now.
There you go. I mean, I often tell the story of when I started Acorn and we decided to move to a dues system, that I was sometimes paid $23 a week, $32 a week. But, you know, when I left 38 years later, it was quite a bigger thing. So, you know, sometimes you have to do those things. Now, you mentioned combining some of the popular education concepts of Paulo Freire, and a lot of people aren't as familiar with that. But you also had experience with the base communities and liberation theology as well when you were in Guatemala, didn't you?
Correct. I, like I said, you know, I because the whole war situation and seeing a lot of friends get killed, in that time, the church, the Catholic Church have a lot of power in Guatemala, and I saw that institution as a way to getting involved with them and organize, you know, from there. And so I went to the seminary. I studied there for 10 years. I got my master's degree in philosophy and theology. And I got ordained as a deacon in order to become a priest. So I decided not to do the last step. I was an advisor for my bishop. And I was, you know, because I felt, you know, that being a deacon was more freedom to do social justice, and my bishop sent me to a very conflictive parish, so Santos, where I grew up, my minister. But after, you know, the peace negotiations and realizing them that we were kind of blessing, you know, that I was in God at this time, I got a call, I guess, from God to leave the official church and do work, you know.
In the People's Church, you might say.
Yeah, correct. You know, and so you know, and I think the church, you know, in Latin America is different, you know, than the church here, more active, more politically engaged. And liberation theology was one of the hot, you know, things, you know, in that time. So then I got married, and I got born there. But because of political situation, again, you know, we came to the United States with my wife and my daughter.
Well, that's right. And we were just in, was with a delegation of organizers in Nicaragua, and we met with several Jesuit priests who'd been active for, you know, years down there. And it is your point about how different some parts of the church are in Latin America and Central America is absolutely true. So what is the Heartland Workers Center doing right now? What are the big issues?
Right now, we are in this second year of vision organizing neighborhoods in Latino borders. And so what we did, what we have been doing is mapping every single, we have, you know, in let us say in South Omaha, World Forum, 18 prisons. And we have been, you know, since the beginning of the year, walking house by house, street by street, neighborhood by neighborhood, and doing a qualitative and a quantitative assessment of issues and also of leaders. And then start organizing something that hopefully will be permanent there to address any political issues, you know, next year, and also be ready for the 2016 elections. But our goal is to increase voting participation in this mid-term elections, and that changes the color of, I think, Nevada.
Now, are y'all also active in statewide issues at the legislative level in Nebraska?
Correct. We are also passing, you know, we are working with the state senators to pass a driving license bill. We're proposing, you know, the bill in January for kids who hold the DACA production status.
Mm-hmm.
And because Nebraska, it is the only state in the United States that doesn't allow the deferred action kids to drive. So we are working, you know, with the state legislators. And also we are working in to keep fighting for bills that will stop the wage theft or unpaid salaries, because it's a big issue here as well. And of course, you know, we are keep pushing to reunite our families and stop deportation. And keep fighting for immigration reform.
Now, you mentioned wage theft. Is that a particularly strong issue in some of the large heavy industries, meatpacking and some of those things, or is it mainly in some of the smaller companies?
It is mainly in the construction industry. And out of the 10 construction workers coming to our offices every day, I would say, you know, that 7 of them, they have that issue. And I would say, you know, without blaming, you know, anybody, but mostly of the bad employers are Caucasian, who knows that workers, perhaps they do not have the proper documentation, and that's why they take advantage of not paying their wages. And also it's a lack of understanding what working rights are all about.
And most of the wage theft, does it fall in the area of not paying overtime or just not turning the clock on correctly, we might say, and letting people work off the clock? Or where are you seeing most of the violations? Because I think this is true in Arkansas and everywhere where people are listening to Wage World.
It is not paying, you know, at all. You know, there are cases where Latinos have been working for 2 or 3 months, you know, and the owner of the company, they don't pay at all, you know, any of the workers, claiming, you know, that they subcontract, you know, somebody else, and they have been getting the money, and they will give the money soon, you know, and then they disappear or they finish their company and start another one. But there are cases where subcontract workers end up with no $50,000, $75,000, $100,000, you know, in their pockets.
Well, that's exactly right, and it's one of those situations where everybody knows to do the right thing, but a lot of people just, it's a predatory situation. If you've got people you think you can take advantage of, too many of these companies do so. There's lawsuits everywhere, and they talk about more federal action, but luckily there is a Heartland Workers Center. So do you all work throughout the state of Nebraska or mainly in the Omaha area?
No, we are working. That's why I'm going to rural area right now. We are working out in rural area and start organizing, you know, what we do in Omaha. But our goal is not to build another Heartland Workers Center. not to teach leaders, you know, how to organize themselves. And the idea is, you know, that in 3 years from now, perhaps they will have their own organization that will be partnering with us and other organizations to keep fighting for justice. You know, and I want to just say something that in terms of this, we have been working with a great state senator, Keith Mello, who, along with our senior organizer, Abby Kret, they were working, you know, hard last year and in this year. The first part of our wages there was a bill was signed by the governor.
Oh, good.
So it is kind of, you know, some type of progress.
We've been talking to Sergio Sosa, the executive director of the Heartland Workers Center, based in Omaha, Nebraska, about their work. We've been talking about the Central American migration crisis for children particularly, and we've been talking about what the Workers Center does. Now, Sergio, how, if anybody wanted to get more information on your work in Nebraska and to support the Heartland Workers Center, how would they do that?
Well, they can go to our web page, www.heartlandworkerscenter.org. And our phone number, you know, if somebody, you know, wants it, is 402-933-6095. Or they can look us in Facebook as well.
Well, you know, Facebook is everywhere, so... and you're on your way, and we certainly have enjoyed spending some time and finding out. This was also, for those of you who want to know more about the story, the coming edition that's hitting the streets now of Social Policy, the quarterly journal read by activists, organizers, academics, and many others, available in most libraries, has a great story by David Bacon, a frequent contributor every couple of years. We're lucky to have David's work, and this one goes into what the children of Central America can teach us, and quotes Brother Sergio Sosa from Omaha several times about his views on migrations. This has been Wade's World on KABF, 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power. This is Wade's World, signing off again for another Friday. We'll see you next Friday to talk to more of the most interesting people in the world.